doctor. I never have a doctor on the pod. I don't know if they're like, you gotta call me Doc. You gotta call me Dr. Matt.
No, Matt is fine.
Matt's good? Okay, Matt's good. We'll keep it casual. Yeah. Cool, man. It's a pleasure to have you on. Been following you for a while. And we'll, let's do the, like, even just for me selfishly, I don't even like, whenever people get into the Zoom, usually there's like some, we go back and forth. We say, what's up? I like doing that on the podcast because I selfishly also want to get to know you. And so do a little bit of your background. And I think how you became so passionate about helping people get healthier. And then also just what led you down the path of naturopathy as to become a naturopathic doctor. And maybe a little bit, if I may, without overstepping, I think the American listener, I think it's just different in America. And I think that there's going to be a misconception about what that is and what that is not. And so let's touch a little bit on that. Cause I'm sure you're aware of misconceptions mm-hmm. around that as a field and a practice.
Yeah. So, just around or about myself rather, and sort of what got me on this, this train, you know, nutrition and whatnot. It started really when I was younger. I, struggled with, I had asthma at some points, quite severe. One particular scary incident I can think of when I was about, I want to say 12 or so. And I struggled with, I mean, allergies, I know that's very common. My skin would break out. I struggled with weight management despite being quite athletic as far as playing all the sports, still struggled in that way. And I had a personal trainer at the time who actually promoted more of a plant-based sort of approach. And I would say that was quite unique, especially at that time. But he's really the one who first incited that idea. And so I, after he wanted me to fill out a food diary for a couple of weeks, I thought I would sort of adopt some of his recommendations and see if I can impress him. And
a little Hawthorne effect, you know?
Yeah. The weight started coming off. My skin was clearing up. I was breathing easier. And you know, there is actually some data on things like fruits and veg, and asthma, particularly in kids. And I was quite young at the time. And so maybe there was a cause and effect there. Obviously can't say for certain in cases of anecdotes like that. But I just noticed some improvements that really corresponded to that sort of dietary change. And the main changes I made were having way more fruits and veggies, smoothies and that, reduced my meat intake. I removed the dairy from my diet at the time as well. And, other than that, I mean, reducing the intake of a lot of the sort of classic ultra processed foods, things like potato chips and sodas in particular. And, so it wasn't a huge drastic change. I certainly wasn't, you know, plant exclusive at that time or vegan, but I started moving in that direction. Then move forward into university a couple of years later as I, you know, started to learn more and more about nutrition, but at the same time started eating more cafeteria food, being at university. I started noticing that I wasn't maybe feeling as good as I was prior, and maybe some of those results I was seeing were slipping back the other way. And that was actually when I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go 100% plant-based on the spot. And I did it my second semester. And it wasn't necessarily for ethical reasons or anything at that time. It was just that for me personally, a hard cutoff is easier. So if I draw the line there, I can stick to it. Whereas if I give myself some wiggle room, I could potentially go much further. And I noticed that happening when I was at school. So that's really why I drew the hard line. Later that year, I watched the documentary Earthlings, and that got me more, educated me on the more ethical side. And of course, that is a huge driver of being 100% in my view now. Whereas, you know, I don't think you can make a strong argument for 100% plant-based versus like 90% for health. I think that is more of an ethical consideration, or if you're like me at the time, just wanting to draw that hard line, you know, so to speak. But yeah, that's really what got me into the nutrition and health space. Now, moving forward, when I was in my undergraduate studies, that's when I worked with, or I spoke with one of my instructors about, you know, just like what I was thinking of doing for my career. She had sort of taken an interest in it because of some of the projects we had done. You would sort of highlight things that you wanted to maybe do moving forward. And she knew that I was interested in both the nutrition side quite a bit, but I also was interested in medicine. And she actually thought, well, you know what? I have a naturopathic doctor I see, and actually there are a couple, and you can maybe get in touch with them and just kind of see what they do. And so I ended up shadowing them for a few days, and I was actually really impressed with sort of the scope of that field, at least here in British Columbia. And we'll get to some of the possible differences in a bit. But they prescribe, they can obviously do nutrition counseling. There's actually a very wide range of modalities that fall under that umbrella. Physical therapies as well fall into that category. So that was actually an area I'd say I excelled at in school, was around the physical medicine, the physical therapies. And so after doing that, I sat in some classes at the school just to kind of get a feel for it, ended up liking it. And that's what I decided to do. And today, as far as my practice, I would say I probably practice a lot like a family doctor would. But I do focus a lot on diet and lifestyle as well. And I have more time to do that in my appointments than a typical doctor would as well, just because they might be limited to, you know, 10, 15 minutes. Whereas because it's private care, I can spend however long they book, say 45 minutes, an hour, and so on. Now, as far as what, let's say, falls under that umbrella of naturopathic medicine, maybe how it differs here from some other places is, for one, there's a number of modalities, and I do not practice all of the modalities. There are things that are not so evidence-based, and I'm very aware of that, and I just don't practice them. It's as simple as that. I would say that here in BC, we are much better than some other jurisdictions because we are regulated here. So if you do things that are clearly against the scientific consensus in various ways, you can be reprimanded for that. There are you know, safeguards in place for things like that. So we do have regulation. The other thing is a lot of provinces and states actually aren't regulated at all. And so anybody can call themselves a naturopathic doctor. There's no regulation. It's sort of like the term nutritionist, where basically anybody can call themselves a nutritionist and no one's going to crack down on you. That's sort of the big problem. And that happens in many of the states. It happens in a lot of Canada. The regulated provinces are BC, Ontario, I think Alberta. It's only a handful of them. And then if you go overseas to like Europe, I was just there, they have no idea what it is because it's just not, there aren't really any sort of regulations around it there. I think similarly in Australia, it's unregulated. I don't know. I don't know all the, you know, different rules and regulations around the world, but I just know that it can be quite different to different places.
What is, I don't want to spend the whole time talking to, you know, diving into what that is. We want to get to the plant-based stuff, but I'm curious, you in particular, because like you said, it can differ from where you are, regulation, not regulation, what part of the entire scope of practice that an individual might practice. What are you seeing people mostly for when you're not starring in podcasts and making really, really great Instagram content? Somebody comes to see you. What do you find? And I don't want to pigeonhole you. I'm sure it's a lot of things, but what are some of the top things people are like, hey, I want to come see Dr. Matthew. What are they coming to see you with?
Yeah. I mean, for one, it is quite a variety for sure. Yes. But some of my, I guess, main focuses, I could say are for one, I actually see a lot of just the plant-based community here in Vancouver, just because they know me for that. So they'll come see me if they have nutritional concerns, they want to review some things, have a bit of a checkup, make sure they're supplementing appropriately. Those are the really simple appointments, we'll say. Also some people who are like pregnancy planning or maybe raising kids and they want to make sure that they're getting what they need. So I work with all of them. Other areas where I work quite a bit is with more like cardiometabolic health. So people with high cholesterol, high blood pressure, prediabetes, diabetes. I work a lot with that population. And then I see everything in between, really.
Sure. Yeah, that's cool. It's nice to hear that one of the things you like is just being able to spend a little bit more time, a little bit more focus on the lifestyle piece. And that is something we could use a lot more of over on our side of the border, for sure. For sure. Let's talk. I was reviewing some notes for today and I broke it down into the good, the bad, and the ugly. It doesn't really fit into those three categories, but I want to start with the good and I want to define what plant-based means. Cause I think even just that word can be misconstrued, those words, and talk about just very generally or specifically a few of the big reasons, like somebody, and I was gonna say, maybe like, let's pretend like we're trying to convince the listener. I don't think we're trying to convince anybody insofar as, here's the data, I believe in it, these are things that we really see in the research. And so what are some of the big bucket reasons somebody might want to consider moving, let's say for now, along the spectrum to a more plant-based approach? And then of course you can touch on kind of what you just said, which was, yeah, maybe where the line of health improvements might be drawn and maybe what makes up the rest of that percentage of, you know, going all the way 100% vegan.
Yeah, so as far as the term plant-based, I mean, it really depends on the person saying it, I guess. But like some people will use it interchangeably with a plant-exclusive diet. A plant-exclusive diet, in my opinion, falls under the umbrella of plant-based diet, but it is not interchangeable. So a plant-based diet, at least as far as the overall balance of like the scientific literature goes and how they refer to plant-based diets, are diets that are dominated by plants. So things like the Mediterranean, DASH, Portfolio, obviously vegan, vegetarian, those can all fit under that umbrella of plant-based diet. And those are all, or can be, quite healthy diets as well. So when I say plant-based diet, I generally mean plant predominant. If I am strict or specifically talking about a like plant exclusive or vegan diet, I will say that. I'll make it clear typically when I'm communicating it. Now, as far as why people might want to make that change, well, all these diets I just talked about, whether it's Mediterranean, al pesco, vegetarian, vegan, they're typically almost across the board associated with lower risks of cardiovascular disease, number one killer in America, number two here in Canada, right behind cancer. Speaking of cancers, reductions in certain types of cancer, especially gastrointestinal cancers, reduction in type 2 diabetes risk, reduction in total mortality. I'm actually going to post a video today as we're recording this on vegetarian diets and mortality, an update from the Adventist Health Study 2, where what they found was reductions in the risk of death at age, say, 65, leading more people to live to those older ages. Now, it's not necessarily going to make you superhuman and have you living, you know, to be far beyond sort of the maximum threshold, but it's at least going to get you to those old ages in the first place and thereby reducing premature death. So there are a number of reasons to make that shift towards more plant-based diets, and it's not all or nothing. We have substitution analyses where they'll basically model, like, if you were to replace a small percentage of your diet from one food with another food, but the rest of it stays roughly the same, what would you expect? And we see very consistently that if you replace even a serving, sometimes less than a serving of red meat a day with a plant protein source, you can significantly reduce your risk of cardiovascular mortality, for example. So it's pretty substantial of a benefit for a pretty small change.
Let's add or subtract to this list that I made in 0.01 seconds while you were talking. If we're looking like big bucket, hey, go, you know, you should, I recommend that in general population level, people eat more plants, go move along the spectrum more towards plant-based diets. We have more fiber, more micronutrients, phytonutrients, more fruits and vegetables, probably more diverse amount of micronutrients, phytonutrients, probably less calories, lower in saturated fat, more favorable fat profile, so probably more MUFA, PUFA, more unsaturated fat, less saturated fat. What else might you put on that list, and maybe which of those do you think deserves a little extra context?
I think you hit some of the big ones, the changes in fat content and the increased fiber, like those are no-brainers. I think one thing people should focus on maybe a little bit when making that change is specifically high protein plant foods, because you're essentially removing what is a common protein source in the animal foods for plant foods. So if you replace beef with rice, I mean, you're reducing your protein intake quite a bit. But if you replace beef with like TVP or seitan or even tofu, like those are pretty rich in protein. So that's something I would emphasize. But one thing I think you're getting that we don't typically measure, really. I mean, there are some studies now that have, but that we don't have an easy way to quantify for the average person because they aren't on nutrition labels, are things like polyphenols, other phytonutrients that are found in the plant foods. And these are compounds that can have like anti-inflammatory, potentially anti-cancer properties and so on. And they can be extremely beneficial. In fact, some of the strongest data for them that I'm aware of was a meta-analysis published, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago. I might be off on that a little bit. But this was a meta-analysis looking at circulating levels of these polyphenols. So they're looking at the levels in your blood. And the only reason they're in your blood is because you consumed them. So it's a really good measure of like, are you eating these foods that contain those compounds? Because you aren't going to make them. And higher intake was associated with, it was something like a 45% lower risk of cardiovascular mortality and a 30% lower risk of total mortality, if I'm not mistaken, or I might have mixed those two up. But either way, substantial in both cases. And so that is like really strong data that these, in that case, enterolactones, which are found in a lot of nuts and seeds, some grains, flax seeds in particular, a great source, were, you know, substantially reducing risk.
I'm cracking up. I just posted a video of Saladino, basically, he was saying something about, they were deciding between whether they should pick the chicken or the beef. You should go with the chicken or the beef. And he's like, oh, I should go with the beef because there's more micronutrients in there. And then he was like, you should go with the grass-fed one. I swear to God, this is a direct quote. He said, because the cows ate the grass, and what that does is it puts beneficial phytonutrients in the meat. And then he said, it's like there's a salad in the beef. I was like, there's no way you just said this. There's no way you are, because he's doing this like very interesting. Interesting is a, I say that tongue in cheek, it's actually just like, just horrible. But this like 180 basically, he's like completely doing 180. He's like making this like, yeah, his like plant-based pasta or whatever. Animal-based pasta or whatever. But like, he was like, there's basically salad in the, he was like, you should eat more phytonutrients is basically what I said. I was like, are you kidding? Like, this is where you're at right now? Like,
But get them from beef.
Yes, like, get them from beef. That is it, the right? Most efficient like, way to get them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, I honestly, I think, and I've spoken with others about this, I think he's playing everyone. I think, like, the stuff he says is so ridiculous, I just can't imagine that he believes it. I think he knows how to play the social media game. I think he knows what gets click, and I add to it by doing these response videos to it, too, so I'm at fault to a degree. But I think he knows exactly what he's doing. He's making more money than any of us ever will. And people are eating it up. Like, it's incredible. Now, if he's genuine in what he's saying, he's got to be one of the like worst, like most inept like people as far as nutrition literature goes out there. But I would give him a little more credit than that. And I think he's playing everyone.
Yeah, yeah. It's a frightening combination of ignorance and intelligence. You know, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about this gap between like where you would draw the line. And we're going to ultimately, for the listener here, we're going to ultimately get to the point where it's like, hey, if you've been intrigued by the podcast, you're looking to go more plant-based, here's what you can do. We're going to get there at the end. But this idea of, you mentioned it earlier and you're like, well, there might not be, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. You can spit it up, chew it back out, whatever, reverse that. There might not be a health benefit beyond 90% plant-based, but I might, you know, in your case, go, your decision to go 100% plant-based was on the ethical side. Let's talk, just reiterate that for the listener who might have glossed over that.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I don't know that the hard line is 90%.
Sure, totally.
The number out there, but to give you a ballpark estimate. So basically, we know that when we look at populations consuming a variety of diets and we assess, like, say, a plant-based diet index, where basically you get points for eating more plants and you get docked points for eating less plants, those with the highest scores have a lower risk of mortality, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, like basically all the common diet-related chronic diseases, compared to those with the lowest scores. So we know that shifting that direction is a good thing. And that's without even considering whether they're healthy plant foods or not. Generally, we see overall plant-based diets are beneficial. If you focus specifically on the healthy plants, it's even more beneficial. And then if you focus on the specifically unhealthy plants, it goes the other way. So just to clarify, diet quality matters, but generally we just see in populations shift towards plant-based or beneficial. Now, those studies tell us, yes, more plants generally better, but it doesn't tell us like necessarily where the cutoff is. Like, is that forever? Or is there some point that we hit where it's just not further beneficial? And to really tease that out, I think we have to look at studies on like healthy omnivorous diets that are mostly plant-based, things like Mediterranean diets, and then studies on diets that are either plant exclusive, like a vegan diet, or at least close to that. And we see that the results from those studies on health outcomes are generally comparable. They aren't like, you know, one might slightly edge out the other in certain ways, but it's not a huge difference one way or another. And so I would say they're roughly similar. So that's why I say it's an ethical decision to go 100%. Now, as far as like, where is that line? I think it's a fluid line. And I think it depends on what sort of animal foods you're talking about here. So if you're talking about incorporating a bit of red meat, you know, if you have it once or twice a week, probably not a big deal. If you're having it every day, even if it's say a single serving, that may increase your risk. And so if the only animal foods in your diet are the red meat, that might still not be optimal. if you're having it daily. But if you're talking about things like low-fat dairy products or yogurt, or you're thinking about fish, you can have more of that. You have more room for that because that's actually generally associated with good health outcomes. So it's not a hard line. And if you are having animal foods with regularity, I would say those are some of the better ones. But if you're talking about red meat, especially if you're talking about processed meats, I think limiting well below daily consumption is ideal.
Can you just briefly talk about the line of processed red meat versus not unprocessed red meat? I don't, obviously that paper came out recently that wasn't really meant to be. And that wasn't really the point of the paper. Yeah. And it made this kind of dichotomy between, okay, unprocessed red meat, there's a correlation with negative health outcomes, but unprocessed meat, that correlation tends to kind of not be as strong and whatever. Internet's losing their mind and a lot of misconceptions about that, but there's going to be people listening to this being like, well, I have processed deli meat occasionally, or I have, is that a hot dog? Is it a processed, is it my roast beef that I have? Is it, what might be the line of, oh, this is a processed red meat, this is an unprocessed red meat?
Yeah. So, well, for starters, if we're using the word occasionally, I would say it doesn't really matter. So if we're for health, I don't think that really matters. You know, if you're talking about once a week or something, I don't see it. You probably smoke occasionally and it not have a meaningful impact. Not that I'm recommending smoking, but you know, you could say that about a lot of things. I don't think that would matter too much. Now, as far as processed meats, these are typically things that have had like salt or other sorts of treatments for preservation. So things like sausages, bacon, deli meats, as you mentioned, those are at least some of the most common ones. And then unprocessed red meats would be things like beef, steak, pork, and so on.
Yep.
And we see processed meat very strongly, very consistently associated with cardiovascular disease, colorectal cancer, type 2 diabetes, and so on, particularly when it's at about a serving a day. And for processed meat, a serving is considered 50 grams, so like a single sausage, typically. For unprocessed red meat, the serving size is generally larger, about 100 grams, or that's close to 4 ounces. It's like sort of the palm of your hand is a typical kind of image that we give. And so that, if you're having that daily, that's associated with a higher risk of things like cardiovascular disease, again, diabetes, certain cancers, not as strongly as the processed meat. So the magnitude of effect isn't as large, so it's not going to increase your risk as much, but still increases your risk and very, very consistently. Now, what a lot of studies will, or what a lot of people will cite as far as studies suggesting that it doesn't increase risk, are studies on low levels of intake. So you'll see people cite studies done in like Asia, for example, where people consuming a lot, quote unquote, red meat are having it like twice a week. And then people who eat low amounts are having it basically never. Whereas in Western populations, if we look at high intake, it's like a serving or two a day sometimes, and low intake is like maybe once a week or something. So you need that difference in levels of intake, and you need the high level to be enough to actually lead to worse outcomes. And so at that level of intake, we very consistently see those outcomes. And I think that is one of the things to look out for. So this recent analysis that was done, even though they weren't looking at meat intake they were looking at meat intake and mortality, but they weren't using that data to suggest that it wasn't associated with risk. They were trying some new methods, some statistical methods to just do like a proof of concept and see how this turns out. People took it and ran with it, of course. But in that one, if I recall correctly, I think average the meat intake was like well below a serving a day. It was like half a serving a day or something like that. And so it wasn't even enough to lead to poor outcomes. So just to sort of clarify a little bit on that.
Cool. No, I appreciate that clarification. When somebody, how would I phrase this? I guess we could just say it. I mean, what are the potential cons? If someone's like, all right, I'm going to go full on vegan, or I'm going to move predominantly plant-based, you having all the knowledge in the world about that, what are your, not reservations, but are you like, oh, make sure you do this, or the on average people might not be thinking about checking this box. What are some of those big ones that come to mind?
I think there's a couple things. So, I mean, one is obviously B12 intake. So yeah, you can rely on fortified foods like fortified plant milks, nutritional yeast, and so on. But I generally suggest everyone just take a supplement. It's so easy. It's one of the cheapest supplements out there. You can do a high dose even weekly. That like here, I do that myself. I get a high dose from just a local pharmacy, and it cost me like 15. Actually, I think it's gone up a little bit to like $20 a year or something.
Yeah.
Like it's nothing. So that's a really easy viable option. Other nutrients, you know, depending on where you live, maybe vitamin D and so on, depending on sun exposure. There are other things that we can talk about, but B12 is the must, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Now, as far as things to do with their diet, for one, I think one of the mistakes that people run into, especially if they're doing this like no salt, no sugar, no oil type thing, like the whole foods purists that you might see, is that their calorie intake ends up being way too low. So if you're going from eating more calorie dense foods very often, especially with a lot of the animal foods, and then you're going to like just fruits and veggies and like super low calorie density foods, you're probably going to end up under eating. Yeah, you might lose weight initially, feel really good, but then you might end up, you know, crashing as far as energy levels, not feel good, have hair falling out. Like, there's all sorts of things that can happen. So focusing on things like some of those grains, particularly whole grains, legumes, nuts and seeds, using oils, don't be afraid of those liquid oils. Incorporating those can go a long way to just making sure that you're getting enough calories to maintain your weight and level of activity. Now, the other thing that I think some people could fall into is the like super low protein intake. So again, we talked about that earlier. If you're swapping out meat for things like rice or veggies, well, then yeah, your protein intake is going to tank. But if you're swapping out the animal foods like meat for tofu, TVP, seitan, some plant-based meat alternatives. I mean, I have a recent paper on that we could always touch on as well. Those can be good options for protein. If you're swapping out milk for a soy milk or pea milk, you can get about the same amount of protein. Or if you were initially drinking whole milk, you actually increase your protein intake with the plant options per calorie. You replace eggs with tofu or even an egg replacement like Just Egg. Those have similar or more protein. So there's a lot of pretty easy swaps. It just takes a little bit of education around like what those swaps are.
Agreed. I'm going to say something, and I want you to do that whole strongly disagree, disagree, strongly agree, agree, and then take it and run with it. Protein equated, it doesn't seem to make a big difference whether it's people getting that from entirely plant sources or omnivorous people. And, you know, the follow-up thought for people that think about it a little bit more deeply is that, okay, well, those aren't complete proteins and you're missing some of the essential amino acids. And so, like, before we have this research of protein-equated outcomes, before we have that, the logical thought would be like, okay, you have animal proteins that are have all the complete essential amino acids, higher amounts of leucine, you know, things that generally you'd be like, yeah, that's good. It's probably good for muscle growth in particular, but also all the other things that protein is good for in our body. So if I go plant-based, now I need to do this Legos of, I got to have the beans with the rice so I have all the complete amino acids. And you know, that I get the intuition there, but it seems like protein-equated, it doesn't seem to matter much. And I'll use muscle growth in particular as like a single outcome, but you know, that's, you know, part of the people listening to this podcast are going to be interested in that. But it does not seem in the research we have protein equated that it matters much for muscle growth, even though we're all, it doesn't have enough of this amino acid. It's low in leucine, blah, blah, blah. It does not seem to actually matter for the outcome that you're worried about, which is muscle growth, if you equate protein. And the follow-up, by the way, is if you can actually get somebody to understand what I just said and be like, okay, like, cool, I agree, that I see the literature, I buy it, I'm not saying that it's funded by big broccoli or something, they will say, okay, but it's a lot harder. And so do you agree with that initial statement, and do you want to add some context? And then what might you say to somebody who said, oh, this is, you know, it's just much harder?
Yeah, so the initial statement, yeah, I agree. I mean, we like plant foods have all of the essential amino acids, but they have them in varying amounts. So they might have less of one amino acid, more of others. And, but the nice thing is when you eat a varied diet, so you're incorporating things like legumes, nuts and seeds, whole grains, and actually some foods like soy actually have a very balanced amino acid profile to begin with. But when you're eating a variety of foods, which I recommend everybody do anyway, like forget about protein just for general health, when you're doing that, it just becomes a non-issue. You don't need to hyper-focus on it at all. The other thing is if you're aiming for those high levels of protein intake that are typically recommended for, you know, strength and muscle gains, So 1.6 grams per kilogram body weight.
Can I pause you on that? Can I jump in there actually really quick and go on a soapbox for a second? Yeah. So 1.6 grams per kg is a 0.77 grams per pound. Is a recommendation from 2018 Morton and colleagues, which is like a great meta, fantastic, like basically like set us on the way of that being the recommendation. You know, they've done some looking, and I'm on my high horse about this 100%. As somebody who's like really into the, you know, talks hypertrophy, talks building muscle, like that's something that's, you know, whatever. Just, I like talking about it. I care about it. If you look at that study and they did an all but one analysis and it wasn't a statistical outlier per se, but there is one study that if you remove that diminishing return probably goes down to somewhere between 1.2 and 1.4 kg.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that that's, by the way, more like 0.6, 0.6 to 0.7 grams per pound, which if you're like 150 pound person's like 0.6 is 90 grams of protein. So, you know, that might shock somebody of like, that's so low. Like it, protein is ironically in the list of things that grow muscle, probably, I know it's kind of hard to say intellectually, it's difficult to say this, but lifting, sleep and total calorie intake are probably more important. Yes, not eating don't eat no protein, but I think we've maybe gone a little bit too far. We've maybe taken, like Gen Pop people have looked a little bit too much at the supernatural pro bodybuilder, you know, 3 gram per kg research. It's like, yes, people who are looking for every gram of muscle is tied to their identity and finances. Maybe you should go higher. But like, if you're like a regular person who wants to be lean, fit, strong and healthy, like, that bar is probably even a little bit lower. So yes, okay, continue, sorry.
And I would agree with that. And actually, so Tagawa did a meta-analysis, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years now, looking at strength outcomes in particular, and it plateaued at 1.5. So it was even a little bit lower, and they did a better job excluding studies where there was weight loss as well. So if you're losing weight and cutting weight, then you need higher protein to maintain. So there are issues with the Morton meta for sure. But I just cite the 1.6 in part because it is, you know, kind of agreed upon, so to speak. But two, it's actually not that hard anyway. So like, that's the other thing, is it's really not that hard to hit that. I cite it as if anything, like a precautionary measure, yes, so to speak, for like squeezing out the last few drops. Totally. But anyways, so sorry, where was I?
Yeah,
I
can't remember. But more of like, if somebody said, hey, it was just more challenging to get that protein in.
Okay, Oh no, we were talking about the amino acids. So yeah, so if you were, say, aiming higher, like is typically recommended for strength or muscle building, then any amino acids that were falling below, say, the cutoff that you need for them, you would be getting generally more than that. So even foods that are low in one of the essential amino acids, if you upped your total protein intake and all you ate was that food, you'd still get enough of that amino acid. Of course, I'm not recommending anybody eat just one food, but the amino acid concerns just really fall flat at the end of the day. I don't think they're really a concern unless you have a super monotonous low protein diet. Now, the other thing that people bring up is digestibility. And I mean, there are a number of issues. I've kind of talked about that at nauseam with the ways that they're scored. But the biggest issue with the scoring systems is that they also essentially dock points based on the amino acid profiles, because they look at single foods typically. So if you look at one food and one of the amino acids falls below whatever threshold you need, then that food's going to get like a score of 50 or 60% or something, when in reality, you're absorbing like 80% of it or 90% of it. So, you know, it's not relevant to a diet where you're eating other foods that will have more of that amino acid. So what at the end of the day matters is the outcomes. Do you get similar muscle and strength gains if you eat the same amount of protein? And yes, you do. We have data supporting that. We have at least a couple trials now on plant exclusive or near plant exclusive diets, where those getting the plant protein get similar gains, no significant differences in any strength or muscle outcomes for compared to the omnivorous diets or the more animal protein based diets.
You're
right. Yeah, go ahead.
I was saying, what are some of your heavy hitters for, hey, like these are some, you know, in my coaching practice, one of the first things I will discuss is just eating pattern, meal structure, building balanced meals. And one of the mantras is, for an omnivore would be, it's kind of redundant as a more plant-based, but would be building meals around a protein and a plant, which in our case are the same. In this context of our discussion today are the same. And so, I mean, I've heard you on other podcasts basically take that exact same approach. Be like, hey, build a meal around a concise protein source. Just so happens to be a plant-based concise protein source. So in that context, what would be some of those heavy hitters to be like, hey, these are some things that are high in protein per calorie. Can, you know, if you are somebody looking for that upper end of protein intake from a protein per calorie perspective, these are some really great go-tos.
Yeah. So, I think, tofu is probably one of the most like versatile, easy to source, options. It's a pretty good source. It generally a bit less protein per gram compared to meat, but per calorie about the same, compared to a lot of meats. So, I mean, as long as you're eating the volume, that's a great source. I love legume-based pastas. And the reason I love that is that it's not generally seen as a protein source. So when you think of pasta, you might get like a few grams per serving, but if you have the legume-based pasta, you're getting 20, 25 grams.
Getting a ton of glyphosate.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's such a rich source. And it's like a sneaky way. And then you can throw some like veggie grounds in there and further up it if you wanted to, or lentils or whatever. Like it's, you can just explode your protein intake with those pastas for dinner. The other ones I really like are TVP, so textured vegetable protein or textured soy protein. So this is sort of, it's like isolated protein. It's not exactly a protein isolate, but some of the fiber has been removed, most of the fat has been removed. And so it's a really dense protein source. And you can get them in these, what are called like soy chunks, or you can get pea-based ones called pea chunks as well, where you just stick them in water for 10 minutes. They hydrate and become very meaty in texture. And then you just cook them however you would for me, like throw them in stir fries or whatever. Awesome, awesome sources, incredibly loaded with protein, about similar to extra lean meats. So a really good source. And then seitan is a good one as well. It takes a little bit longer to make if you're making it yourself, but you can also purchase it. And a lot of the plant-based meats are made from it as well. And that's a gluten-based protein. So if you have celiac disease or issues with gluten, it's not a good source. But those would be some of the like really big heavy hitters. And then, of course, a protein supplement. So there's like no problem with using that as a snack. Or like I put it in my oatmeal, not even necessarily because I need the protein, but I like the flavor. I like, you know, it adds a nice flavor to the oatmeal. So that's another option.
Awesome. Let's hone in a little bit on plant-based meat. Feels like an oddly contentious topic. Where do you feel it is or is not actually contentious? I mean, what are some of the common misconceptions, claims, things that you hear about it and you're like, that's not at all true. That's not what plant-based meat is. It's, you know, it's mm-hmm. processed. It's got highly inflammatory seed oils. Those would be the two big ones that jump to mind for me, but you okay. maybe run into some more.
Yeah. So, I mean, for starters, I did recently publish a paper on this in the Canadian Journal of Cardiology. It was a review on plant-based meat alternatives and cardiovascular disease in particular. So I think I could say I've done my digging into this topic. One of the concerns is the list of ingredients. It's always like, oh, the list is so long, it's a problem. You see the memes floating around on social media. And I think what you have to understand is if you look at some of these products, I'd say most of these products, and you go through that ingredients list, the vast majority of them are just nutrients. They have these scary looking names. Ergo calciferol would be like vitamin D if they add it. Cyanocobalamin would be B12. They might add like riboflavin, which is another B vitamin. There's so many of them that they can sound sort of scary, but they're really just added nutrients, which make the product better. You want those in there. So that's one thing. Now, as you mentioned, seed oils, I mean, that's a whole other issue, I guess, to tackle. But for one, a lot of products don't. A lot of them use things like olive oil. The new Beyond Burgers use avocado oil, so it's not always the case. But even so, they have never been shown in a single human trial to increase inflammation, full stop. There literally is not one, even though that's claimed. And the best meta-analyses of randomized controlled trials, in fact, the best randomized controlled trial, or arguably the best in nutrition period, or one of the best, the LA Veterans Administration Hospital study, suggested that replacing animal fats with the vegetable oils actually reduces risk of cardiovascular outcomes. And so the evidence for these oils is incredibly strong. We also have measurements of tissue levels. So when you consume them, they get incorporated into your tissues, at least those polyunsaturated fats do, and those with higher levels have a lower risk of cardiovascular outcomes again. So there's really no reason to be concerned about them anyway, but even if you were, there are plant-based meats without them. So it seems to be a non-issue.
Really quickly for the listener, I'd like to read out the ingredients just the new Beyond Meat, Beyond Burger.
Yeah, go for it.
First ingredient's water, then yellow pea protein, So pea protein. This one has avocado oil in it. And the irony of them putting avocado oil is I think that they're like, that's an appeal to people who are worried about seed oils. Like that they're like, fine, fuck it. We'll put avocado oil in it. You know, like people will buy it more. Yeah. Natural flavors, which I think that there, people would have a conniption over, which absolutely is just like most mind-numbing thing of all times. Totally fine. Yeah. Brown rice protein, red lentil protein, 2% or less of methylcellulose, which is, again, if I'm
mistaken, like a fiber. Yeah. The structure. Yeah. And
potato starch.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. Potato starch, pea starch, potassium lactate, fava bean protein, apple extract, pomegranate concentrate, potassium, spice, vinegar, vegetable juice color with beet juice. I'm not, where's the red flag? Where's the worry? Where are people getting so worked up over?
Yeah, I don't know. And I would say that's not a unique case either. You can look at a number of products and you'll see similar lists.
Yeah.
Like it's just funny that it gets spun to be this big, you know, dangerous product apparently. But like just going back to the data, looking at it, I mean, what we have to do ultimately is step back and look at like, what effect does this have on our health? And there are some randomized controlled trials. So at the time of writing our review, there were six. Now there have been a couple others since, and the results are generally the same across the board. We see reductions in total and LDL cholesterol. We don't see any significant impact on blood pressure, despite some of the products being high in sodium. The new Beyond is pretty low in sodium, but just generally speaking, they can be high. So no significant impact on blood pressure. We see a couple studies where there's reductions in either body weight or waist circumference. Like there are just benefits or neutral effects, like depending on the marker. There really is no signal for harm. And so it seems to be very manufactured, this controversy over them.
It's also, by the way, like you saying, you defending the incorrect claim that they are mega high in sodium. And I don't want to use Beyond Burger, like you said, I don't use Beyond Burger as like a proxy for every single plant-based meat option. This is just a one that people will know by name. It has a 310 milligrams in one patty, 230 calories, 21 grams of protein. But the funny thing is, the same people who are shitting on Beyond Burger are shoveling electrolyte supplements down your throat and saying that more salt is better. And so you got to start critiquing it for being low in sodium, if anything.
It's
sad. Okay, excellent, super duper fun. And you mentioned lentil pasta, and I my brain hurt from like the Moms Across America glyphosate thing. But yeah, plant lentil pasta, bonza pasta, all of them fantastic, really really awesome options. Let's talk about, I want to circle back to nutrient deficiencies, and I'm gonna list a bunch, and I want you to tell me which ones are worth opening up a little bit of a discussion about, and which ones maybe you're like, hey, let's grab a good quality multivitamin, you're going to be okay. So you mentioned B12, maybe it's in a multivitamin, but a very cheap, easy way to take that separately. Maybe a vitamin D, you get easy with a blood test, you can see, depending on where you live in the world, what your life's like, you might be fine. Calcium, I think you said if you're not having dairy foods, if you're removing dairy, but you're not replacing them with maybe plant-based milks, maybe there's something there.
I would say fortified milks for sure. But if you're not having that, then maybe consider a supplement.
I'll list a bunch and we can circle back. So
we'll go through the math.
Zinc, creatine, iodine, iron, omega-3s.
Zinc. Okay. I'm going to see if I got this in the email. No. Okay. You're going to have to repeat.
Yeah. We'll start with zinc. Basically, zinc, creatine, iodine. Go ahead.
So zinc is, zinc is an interesting one because the RDA that we have, so the amount that is recommended to consume daily, it was developed in a very odd way. It's different than a lot of the other RDAs where it's actually looking at like deficiency rates. In this case, it was more so based on how much you'd have to consume to maintain sort of the average levels in the population. So we don't know for sure like how good that reference range is and whether the low end really is the low end or if it could be lower. That said, vegans do tend to have, either similar or lower levels depending on the study. So in some studies, it'd be a similar level. Once in a while, it might be a bit lower. But the blood test also isn't super good for assessing zinc levels. At the end of the day, I'm not clear that vegans have higher rates of zinc deficiency. I haven't seen good data supporting that, or at least clinical deficiency. But I also don't think it's a terrible idea if you are getting a multivitamin to get one with a bit of zinc in there, just to cover your bases. But I would stop short of saying that it's an absolute necessity by any means. I don't think the data really supports that. But if someone wanted to be extra cautious, I don't see a problem with it.
Cool. I sent the other ones in the chat there. Let's do creatine.
There you go. Yeah. So creatine is not an essential nutrient. We make it. We do not need to consume it. There are benefits to supplementing creatine for at least strength gains and like power output during exercise. So I think it's a good idea for athletes for sure. There's potential for some other benefits. So there's potential for some benefits on bone health parameters. That might be just because it helps with physical activity. It might help. There's very limited evidence on some like cognitive parameters, although I'm not super convinced by that data at this point. I think it's pretty weak, but it's possible. So I would put in the same park of like, well, if you're an athlete, yeah, great idea for optimizing performance. But otherwise, I would stop well short of saying it's a necessity, but it's something that you could definitely consider for those reasons I mentioned. Now, iodine is something that if you are not consuming iodized salt, is probably worth considering. Vegans do tend to have lower urinary iodine levels, but that is the same. But all dietary patterns have on average low urinary iodine levels. So they'll look at even pescatarians who eat fish and their levels are low. So it's not a vegan specific issue. And again, maybe the true deficiency doesn't arise until you're really, really low, because we don't really have good data suggesting that vegans have higher rates of things like hypothyroidism, which would be a consequence of iodine deficiency. But just use some iodized salt. Or if you're not having salt and you want an alternative, a potassium-based salt alternative that is also iodized, unless you're on certain medications that affect like blood pressure, or if you have kidney disease in those cases, you have to monitor potassium intake. So obviously that would be something to speak with one's doctor about. But yeah, I would say either do that or supplement if you're not going to do iodized salt. Iron is an interesting one, because vegans don't tend to have a high risk of deficiency in the available studies that we have, at least on average. They do tend to have lower levels on average, but still within what's considered a normal range or a non-deficient range. And iron deficiency is just the most common nutrient deficiency in the world. It affects everybody particularly women, but across dietary patterns. And so in cases of deficiency, yeah, supplementation might be necessary. In fact, high dose supplementation might be necessary. And that is something that would be worked on with a doctor as well to raise levels. And this is, again, something that applies to a range of dietary patterns. It's not a vegan specific issue. And generally speaking, men don't really have to worry about it. Of course, there can be cases where it is a problem, but it's not super common. And usually if men are iron deficient, it's a red flag for losing blood somewhere that, you know, needs to be further investigated. And then with the omega-3, so we consume alpha-linolenic acid, which is the short chain omega-3 found in plant foods like flax, walnuts, chia, hemp, soy. And we can convert some of that into EPA and DHA, which are the long chain omega-3 fats that a lot of people will get from fish and in small amounts in other animal foods. But, you know, the debate is, do we convert enough? And we actually convert a decent amount to EPA, but we don't convert a ton to DHA, which is the one that's thought to be a bit more important for brain health. So this is an area where I would really like to see data on vegans who supplement versus vegans who don't, because vegans would be the dietary group who doesn't consume any EPA or DHA, full stop, unless they're supplementing. And you can supplement from algae-based sources, which would be a vegan source. So that's something that I'm waiting for to really solidify my position on it. As it stands, I would say there isn't good evidence of benefit with increasing the EPA and DHA intake in healthy individuals, but there is some evidence of benefit in people with early signs of cognitive decline. There is some evidence of benefit in people with cardiovascular risk factors. And then where there's most clearly benefit, in my opinion, is during like pregnancy and breastfeeding. I think then absolutely supplement through there, because the data is certainly more convincing. So where I sit on that as far as recommendations go is generally like, again, it can be considered a precautionary measure to supplement until we have that more solid data on like vegans specifically, because I think that would really settle it. But it is also a more pricey supplement, so that's something to consider. And if there is some benefit to be had, at least for healthy individuals to supplement, my guess is that it's relatively small, that benefit, just because the trials that we have on healthier populations have not yielded significant results. And if that's the case, like maybe there is a result and it's within that, you know, confidence interval somewhere. And so it's just not really super clear at this point. So that's sort of how I would highlight those nutrients. I can't remember if there were more.
No, you did great. You got all of them. You did great. My follow up is just, how should somebody think about these? Is this somebody's like, hey, I'm going plant-based, let me just hit the kitchen sink with all these? Or is it like, hey, let me get my blood checked, or hey, let me do a urine test for iodine? Or like, is it something that people are like, oh, I gotta get frequent tests on this? Or is it like hey, I'll grab a multivitamin and maybe I'll grab this, you know? How closely should people be keeping an eye on their levels of some of this?
Yeah, so I think if you have access, I mean, getting tested for them is great to have a better idea of maybe what's important if you wanted to pick and choose. But I actually think just going for a simple multi makes life so easy. And so if you had a multi, like even if you don't need the added zinc, obviously you don't want to go crazy high dose or anything, sure, but in the multi, it's typically not going to be, but you want the B12, let's say you want the vitamin D. I'm up here in Canada, so that's something I would want. You get a bit of zinc, you get your iodine needs met, sometimes with a little bit of iron or whatever else is in there. That just helps cover your bases a bit and makes it really easy to not have to think about it.
Awesome. Awesome. Super helpful. Let's shut it down here with someone's intrigued, listen to the podcast. It's been compelling. They want to get the health benefits of moving their diet along the spectrum to a more plant-based approach. What are some of the big rock steps that you would suggest they take?
So I like to start with like simple swaps. So and I would focus specifically on the protein. So swapping out like a plant protein for animal protein. So if you're typically having, you mentioned deli meats earlier, let's say you're having a ham sandwich for lunch or something, just replace it with a smoked tofu, maybe even a plant-based ham or something. Funny enough, those actually tend to be pretty low in sodium and saturated fat, at least the ones that I've seen, or plant-based turkey slices in particular, very low in sodium. So something like that would be a really simple swap to make for dinners. If you're usually having, I'll go back to the pasta example. If you're usually having pasta with like a meat sauce, you just replace that with some lentils in the sauce, or perhaps a veggie grounds in the sauce, or maybe swap out for a lentil pasta. Those are things that you can do to essentially consume the same meal or same type of meal, but just make small changes. And so you don't have to learn a lot. So that's one of the big roadblocks, I think, is people think they need to like overhaul their diet, learn how to make all new things, when really you can probably take what you're already eating and just make some little tweaks and shift towards that more plant-based diet and more plant protein specifically.
Yeah, I love that. It feels like you would need to make a big shift in principles in how you would be building meals, or it would diverge a lot from the common best practices around meal construction. It doesn't, like a lot of fruits and vegetables, some starches, some unsaturated fat, and a concise protein source is still a really great, maybe not every single meal all the time needs to be perfectly like that and perfectly balanced, but as a general way of thinking about, hey, I need to build a balanced meal most of the time, I think those principles remain the same. Something I wrote down was, you know, someone who's intrigued, like, and it's just right with what you said, but just like I wrote like verbatim, I wrote friggin' try a plant-based protein source. Just fucking try it. Like, is highly likely that you've never had a Beyond Burger. It's highly likely that you never had a plant-based meat alternative. It's highly likely that you've never had the Bonza pasta instead of the regular pasta. Like, I just feel like there's like a little bit of that, I don't know, maybe that like picky eating mentality of, I don't want to try, it's going to be gross. Oxymoronic, right? I mean, it's like a fake, you know, they're those sorts of words around it that I think is a barrier for some people. And I bet you would not notice if I did not say something to you. Well, you might, whatever, you might notice, but like if I didn't say something to you and you had a ragu of meat-based pasta sauce with the Bonza, and I was like, hey, these are like vegan crumbles and on top of this Bonza pasta with meat, with sauce or whatever, like I'm sure it would be delicious, you know, not exactly the same, but I'm sure it would be delicious.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I've seen that. I know my dad's like tricked his soccer team and stuff before by giving. I think he took to a barbecue like Beyond Burgers or something they didn't know. But people they will say that they can tell a difference or don't like it a lot more often if they know what it is versus when they don't. So a lot of it seems to just be up here.
Yeah, and obviously obviously eating more fruits and vegetables, yeah. Increasing, portion sizes of fruits and vegetables, diversifying the fruits and vegetables you are getting. Do you feel, I know we're only a couple minutes. I won't take too much of your time. Do you feel like there's some, I don't know, maybe just some things I've seen with clients where it's, they go plant-based without an improvement in nutrition quality. So they're like, well, I'll just like you said, they're making swaps, but they're swapping a predominantly ultra-processed diet for a similarly ultra-processed diet, but just with like, okay, there's no plants in here,
Well, I'm sure that happens, especially when people, they see a documentary or something and I make the change. When I'm working one-on-one with someone, that doesn't necessarily happen because obviously I'm guiding them. It's a little bit different. But I'm sure that does happen. That might not be the best swap to make, but hopefully it's a stepping stone towards a healthier diet.
And the last one is just, let's say somebody goes plant-based, they hear us, they're like, oh, I'm going to eat a bunch of fruits and vegetables. And all of a sudden their fiber goes from 7 grams a day to 47 grams a day. And they're like, I don't feel good. I'm bloated. And there's just now I've built this negative connotation with what I've done, which is eat more plants. Can we speak to that really quickly? And I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah. Some people can be sensitive to those really big changes in fiber consumption, like overnight. And so that's another thing is taking slower steps, like I was talking about, simple swaps to begin with, and then slowly progressing might be a little bit easier on the gut. It's also worth noting that in studies on like legumes in particular, so beans, lentils, and so on, that can cause some gas and bloating. That tends to wane over time. So when you're habitually having it, that effect diminishes. And I think, I can't remember, it was by about a month, I think 2/3 or so of participants, I might be a little off on the number, but they were no longer experiencing the gas and bloating. And then by 3 months, almost nobody was. So it just takes a little bit of time, a little bit of patience. But to mitigate that, take those slower steps and go based on your own tolerance as you sort of play around a little bit.
Cool. Awesome. Let's do the old podcast thing. Let people know where they can find you, social media, whatever you want to plug. This is the time.
Sure. Yeah. You can follow me on basically all the social medias at dr.matthewnagra. Instagram is where I'm most active, but I post to all of them, YouTube, TikTok, etc. Also have a website, drmatthewnagra.com. And if you happen to be in BC, Canada for any reason and want to work with me, I am accepting patients there as well, but unfortunately only in BC at this time.
Yeah, that was going to be a question I had, is if you were working with people. Yeah. Cool. Excellent. Maybe you have recommendations for people that do work online, so there might be something there. So cool. Super appreciative of your time, man. You do an amazing job. And I think there's, I think there's sometimes, I don't know, when you put someone's dietary belief and they are tied to it, I'm not saying you're tied to it, but like, I have you here because you are a subject matter expert on this topic. You do a good job not being a zealot about it, like really evidence-based and just whatever. Just like, you do a good job not being a zealot, super evidence-based, like balanced, like not shoveling down 100% vegan down every single person's throat, just being like, hey, here's what we know. And I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, I think overselling some things probably hurts the movement a little bit more.
Yeah, that's well said. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.